Hi, welcome to the 12th House Podcast. I'm Michelle, your co-host and the head witch in charge here at Holisticism. Delighted to have you. Welcome back to the squirrels who have been here before, to our new squirrels. Hi, how's it going? The 12th House Podcast is a little corner of the internet where we bring together creativity, inspiration, intuition, spiritual shit, the metaphysical, the practical, tactical stuff that comes to running a business. And we bring it to you so that you can do your sacred work, so you can self-actualize, so you can be the biggest you could possibly be. It's really fun. You're going to like it, I think. Anyway, let's get into today's episode. Hey, it's Michelle. So I'm tuning in because we had some slight technical difficulties. Yes, we recorded during Mercury retrograde, so it's to be expected. But my mic and my sister's sound are a little funky on this episode. Sorry for the low quality, but maybe you can just pretend that you're on a three-way call with us. I don't know. That's kind of what it sounds like to me. Just wanted to let you know, we did our best to clean it up and make it as listenable as possible. So hopefully you still get through the app because it's a pretty good one. But Mercury microphones, they have a mind of their own sometimes. Hope you enjoy this episode and thanks for tuning in for our three-way call. Hi, Mel.
Hi. Happy to be here.
I'm so excited that you're making your appearance, your premiere on the 12th House Podcast.
I know, me too. I feel like I've been haunting Holisticism for, I don't know, 10 years now. So it feels right.
Since before it was even freckle in my eye, you've been haunting it.
Yeah, pretty much. Story of my life.
Really. Yeah. And if you're listening to this, is Michelle on echo mode? Is she talking to herself? Kind of. I'm talking to my sister, my best friend, the sort of 2.0 version of me, because my parents tried the first time around, then they were like, I think we could do a little bit better. Let's try again. And then they got Mel. My sister, Melanie Pelazon Malang. Mel, welcome to the 12th house. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you. I am too. I'm honored.
Well, we're here for Friday Philosophies, which means I'm going to do what I've been doing to you for probably my whole life, which is talk at you for a little bit about a concept that I'm obsessed with, and you are going to pretend to be interested and engaged because you're a delightful person, and then we're going to talk about it. But I really wanted to have you on for this conversation to talk to you about prolific people because of what you're up to right now. You're in your second year of grad school. Can you tell people a little bit about what you're studying and your focus?
I certainly can. I am in my second year of a couples and family therapy program. So at the culmination of that program, I'll receive a degree in a master's in marriage and family therapy, technically. I like the term couples and family therapy. It's a little bit more inclusive. So the goal for that will be for me to become a therapist. It's a big pivot from what I was doing before, but you know, when you turn 30, things shift, things fall into place in a big way.
Life happens, man, and it's crazy. Yeah, what were you doing before? Tell people really, really briefly what you had done in your early 20s and mid-20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lived life in the chaotic lane. I worked in entertainment for 4 years. Mm-hmm. After graduating from college, I worked at a talent agency, then a production company, and then I switched over to ad tech, specifically working with TV ads and machine learning. So basically, the crux of that is how can we help startups and their marketing teams better measure TV ads? Because those are really challenging to measure. And in a lot of ways, that was fun. And then the pandemic hit and I realized, oh, wow, I don't know if I can do this for the rest of my life. I don't know. There's just something about this that feels like it wasn't for me at that time. And no knocks to anyone in that industry. I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot doing it. But again, with the pandemic, I'm sure a lot of people felt this way. Like things just really shifted for me priority-wise. What filled my cup changed and, you know, things became clearer to me in terms of how I wanted to not only spend my time, but contribute to the communities around me. And so that put things into high gear, basically, of, you know, at 28, how do I start over in this career that I have no experience in? I know no one in, but I am a stubborn Leo, and for me, a challenge is really fun. So I thought, let's do it and see what happens. And here I am.
You're so young. 28 is like,
I know.
It's so young. It's so young. Oh my God. I started Holisticism at 28. I didn't know what I was doing. It's so, you're a baby. It's, you have plenty of time.
Well, I'm 31 now.
But like you're still a baby. Yes.
Totally.
You're basically the same age as Rhodes, you know?
I'm also learning how to walk alongside him. Hobbling along like a little gremlin. Yes. That's what grad school feels like.
Taking four naps a day. Yeah, that is grad school. That's true. There's so much you guys have in common. That's why you're my two favorite people in the world. I mean, obviously so many people can relate, especially listeners of the 12th House Podcast. to waking up and being like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? And I hate my job. And excuse me, I'm supposed to do this for 40 more years. I think I'm like, I'm not joking you. I remember that moment at my job. I was like sitting at my desk and I was like, I literally thought I'm wasting my life here. Like I'm every moment that I'm here, I'm wasting my life. It would be better to just quit and go work at a juice store, you know, like, because this is so, it's like sucking the life force out of me. It sounds so dramatic, but that's the truth of it. Really, when you know that you're in the wrong space.
Yeah.
It's like having a pebble in your shoe that you just need. You need to kick it out. You need to stop what you're doing and just end it.
You know, it was my super bleak wake-up call was one day I woke up. So this was a year and a half into the pandemic. I was working really long days, like many of us were, because we were stressed. It was like the only thing we could do was work, right? Mm-hmm. Work and watch TV. And I remember one day I was like, man, wouldn't it be nice if I just like got hit by a car and broke my leg and was in the hospital for 2 weeks so I could just like take a break? And I like had that thought and like kind of thought through it. And I was like, oh my God, I need to quit.
I need to seek treatment. I am unwell for that.
Mentally ill.
But I mean, anyone out there, you're lying if you haven't had a thought where you're like, wow, I wish I could just be like really sick for 2 weeks and no one could bother me. And
right. Right.
When you're really stressed or burnt out, you're like, oh my God. Yeah. Being in the hospital, being in a coma would be such a nice vacation, such a relaxing.
Doesn't sound that bad.
You know, you have been hit by a car before. So.
And listen, that's why I was like, I can rationalize this because I have been hit by a car. I know it's bad, obviously. I wouldn't wish it upon someone, but I can do it. I can do it.
You're like, I survived once. I mean, I'll take those odds. I'll try it again.
Run it back. Yeah, exactly. So that was my cue of maybe it's time to pivot.
You know, it's good that you had that moment of recognition. So speaking of mental health, I wanted to have you on because this exploration is of prolific people and what makes prolific creators and people prolific, like how to be prolific based on all these case studies that I've been researching and reviewing. And I'm going to go into it in a second, but I think mental health is very much intrinsically tied to the desire to be prolific. I think based on your experience, because I know you've actually worked with some prolific writers and creators at your agency job and in production.
Yeah.
And now as you're entering the world of mental health, what's your sort of like take on someone who is prolific? What comes to mind for you of their personality or how they approach their work?
What comes to mind for me when I think of someone who's prolific is someone that is inherently odd. And we should reclaim that term of being odd, because in my mind, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a fucking weirdo. In my mind, that just means that you are so secure in your identity that can sometimes come across to people as super intimidating or strange, because you are so clear on your intentions, your motivations, what makes you tick, and what inspires you. So to me, the people that I see as prolific are those odd people that are so dead set on achieving whatever that means to them, is really how I classify, oh, you've reached that tier in which you are unlike the others around you, the community around you. You kind of separated yourself from the gap there because you operate differently. You see yourself differently, and therefore you can push yourself to these heights that may not feel reasonable for others. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
You're making me think of Jane Austen would call them queer. She's very queer. She's very odd.
Yeah.
You know, like particular. Yeah. And what that makes me think of is just someone who is so either confident in themselves and is unbothered by other people's, you know, perceptions of them, or cares about what other people think of them, but cares more about doing the thing. And they're like, dang, I really wish people liked me and I wish I wasn't so fucking weird, but like, I have to do this thing, you know?
Yeah.
Do you have, did you sign an NDA for UTA? Can you like talk about some of the people you worked with?
You know, I signed an NDA, but because I quit in 2017, it's probably up by now.
Okay. Because you worked with, you worked on the desk that covered Ryan Murphy, right? And he's a pretty prolific creator.
I worked on some Ryan Murphy shows at my production company, actually. Yes.
Right.
Yes. So yes, I'm like 2 degrees separated from Ryan Murphy. Never met him personally, but worked at
GM in
his team.
A pretty odd person.
100%.
Can you color that a little bit more? Or are you not allowed to say?
For the most part, I've learned that if you don't have anything nice to say, you shouldn't say anything at all. So that's kind of what's coloring my perspective. But
okay.
I will say this about him. he is someone that he has visions about what he wants to produce and nothing stands in the way of getting there, for better or for worse. And I think that's probably true of a lot of prolific people. I think that there's no sort of boundaries or guardrails or road bumps or speed bumps that feel like inconquerable to them. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's very true of Ryan Murphy. Mans has a whole slate of thousands of shows that he's constantly thinking about and tinkering about. He knows like all the meticulous details of the ins and outs of his business. And in some ways, like, I imagine that's admirable, but in a lot of ways, I think that that can really infringe upon a person's sense of relation to others around them. So I can see how that might feel really isolating for someone and really, really difficult too, to be in that position.
Do you remember anything or know anything of his work style, like how he would write, or were you not privy to that information?
I wasn't privy to how he would write. I was privy to how he interacted with writers in the writer's room, though. And I imagine this is probably true of other prolific people, in that the bar of expectations is quite high. And
oh, yeah,
that might
totally be
enforced on others around them. Again, maybe not realistic in some capacities. So that can really either motivate a team or a report, for instance, or someone in the writer's room that you're working with, or that can really manipulate them. Unfortunately, I imagine in many cases, you don't know until you try and you see, like, how are these people going to oscillate and adapt to me when I'm in this room and I'm this unstoppable force? Now, I think he's in a different position in that he came into many of these rooms that I was, you know, adjacent to, with this already well-established name and career. So there is a lot more flexibility to be a badass in ways that maybe people wouldn't encourage or we wouldn't necessarily condone.
But to your point, he had a name, and this is something that we're going to see repeated with prolific people, is they just do a lot of shit. Like, they just keep, he has a name because he's just made so many shows, right? And a lot of them weren't good. A lot of them were panned. A lot of them were canceled, but he just kept showing up. And that's a theme with prolific people.
I would say too, that I imagine that many prolific people may not be terrified of the consequences, or they see the potential outcome as outweighing consequences. And so let's take Ryan Murphy for an example. He has had a ton of horrible shows, but he's had, you know, three or four that have really kicked off. And that's how people identify and see him. And so in his mind, and I know this from working with his team for about 2 years or so, that didn't stop them getting kicked by FX and getting a show canceled or whatever it may be. Like, that was just another Wednesday for them. So I think that's another resiliency piece, maybe, of knowing that, okay, some days it's not going to work and the consequence is not going to be helpful for me, but that's not going to bother me because I know that I can do more and I'm not bothered by it.
Dude, you're like looking at my outline right now. You're taking, you did ESP on me and you're like, in a reverse, I'm actually going to bring up the stuff that you wanted to bring up.
Oh,
so this is great. Let's put a pin in Ryan Murphy and let's talk about prolific people and what they have in common. One thing about me is that I am very, very lazy, and it's confusing because I'm really good at working really hard, but in my core, in my soul, I'm really a slug. I'm a slug on the sofa. That is my true calling. And the more often I can be blob, the happier I tend to be. And so, you know, running a business doesn't necessarily like work cohesively, isn't necessarily synergistic with big blob energy, but I found it's actually like more doable than one might think. And that's why I created Creators Cashing In. Creators Cashing In is one of our Notion for Magical Baddies classes, meaning it's taught live inside of Notion, and you get tons of Notion templates to go along with the course. It's our Notion for Magical Baddies class that I created for the creators among us who make content and want to get paid for it. If you're a writer, if you're a podcaster, if you're a teacher, a guide, if you're someone who wants to run a community or has a community, but you haven't figured out how to make it a fair energetic exchange for the work that you do, Creators Cashing In is for you. And really, like I said, I'm lazy. The reason I created it is because these businesses, while so fun, can be really emotionally exhausting and really just like time intensive, especially if you're unorganized and you don't see how everything comes together. And for the nonlinear thinkers among us, myself included, that part, getting it all organized, prepped, systematized, can be really, really difficult. And in the muddling through every single day and always feeling like you're behind deadline and like you're not making enough money and like you're not sure if the next step that you're making is the right one, not only does that just objectively suck, scientifically, it makes your creativity plummet by, you know, at least 400%. Allegedly. And the point of Creators Cashing In is to help creatives like you and me, nonlinear thinkers, get organized, get clear, and monetize the incredible content and knowledge that they're already sharing with the world. So good news, Creators Cashing In is open, doors are opening, and I would love to have you in the course. I won't be teaching this again for at least another 6 months, but it's one of my favorite things to teach. And there's a ton that I've added into the course this time around. So if you're thinking of running a digital course, selling digital knowledge working products, building a community, monetizing your podcast or your email newsletter, this course is for you. I'd love for you to join us, and you can learn more at the link in our show notes. You know, there's so many prolific artists and creators throughout history, present day. I'm going to give some examples, but I wanted to go specific into one person just because it makes it a little bit easier to illustrate a point. And I picked someone specifically for you, Mel Mel. But before we get into today's topic or person, some prolific people, can you name a few off the top of your head?
Okay, you know what's a hot take prolific person? Ted Bundy.
Oh my God. I was not prepared for that. I was thinking creators. I was thinking artists. I was not thinking serial killers.
Sorry.
I really took it dark there. Yeah, that was very dark. You live in Seattle, so I guess it's always on the mind, the serial killers. Okay, sure. I will take that into consideration. I was really thinking more people who hone their craft as opposed to psychotic serial killers, but okay, fair. I'll give you some examples that I have written down. Leonardo da Vinci, Pablo Picasso, actually in the world records book as the most prolific artist. He has an estimated 50,000 artworks that he's created. Wow. Frida Kahlo, Georgia O'Keeffe, Isaac Asimov, the author. Prince, Nina Simone, Beyonce, Dolly Parton, Woody Allen, boo, hiss.
Tomato.
Catherine Bigelow, Frank Lloyd Wright, again, boo, hiss. Marie Curie, Karl Lagerfeld, Coco Chanel, Diane von Furstenberg, we love her, she's great. Taylor Swift, Bob Dylan. We have so many examples of prolific creators in the world, but today we are going to dive into one of your favorites, Mel. I don't know if you have an idea of who she might be.
My wheels are turning.
She's an author.
Okay.
She's British.
Go on.
She's dead. Any ideas?
Okay, I kind of think Agatha Christie.
Yes!
Love it. Okay,
so Agatha Christie, we know her. We love her. She's one of the most prolific mystery writers of all time.
Yeah.
She had a really unique writing process, and she put out books and plays like clockwork, dude. She just was like a bat out of hell for a really long time, not just for a short sort of blurb, but for her entire life pretty much. And she had a really interesting process. I'll just get into it really quickly, and then we'll talk a little bit about what Agatha Christie sort of represents and her as a prolific person. So she would start with the idea of a murder or a method of murder in a very particular setting. So she'd be like, murder with an ice pick, or she'd be like, everyone's stuck in a room in the middle of a blizzard and one person dies and no one gets out. And her travels were also really inspirational for her for how she decided to come up with stories and themes. And she might even just meet someone and have an idea of, oh, I want to make this person a character in the next thing that I write. That's how she came up with her
Hercule Poirot. What a flex that would be.
Like, or not. What if she makes you just like the most heinous character? It's so obnoxious.
Yeah.
She's like, I wrote something for you, and it's actually like just an like, absolute sick burn for 300 pages. And she didn't use an outline at all. She would store everything up in her little brain. And that's, I think, probably why she had to work so quickly, is because she had to get things out onto paper.
Mm-hmm.
She'd mentioned that she'd plan an entire book in detail in her head before she started writing.
Wow.
And it was usually she would do all of that while she was relaxing. She would take super long baths. She would have long, luxurious dinners. She went on a hell of a lot of vacations. And that was when she would do all of her writing and planning all up in her head. And she wasn't really regimented when it came to her actual writing process, which is a little bit different than what we see from like many people who are prolific, who tend to be very ritualized or regimented or routined with the work that they do.
Yeah.
She would just write whenever and wherever she could. So I think in a way, she was kind of regimented in the fact that she wrote all the time. So she would always show up to write. She didn't say, I have to write 500 words today, but she would always have something around her so that she could do her practice. It wasn't like she had to have the perfect setting and situation in order to do her work. Mm-hmm. And she also really hated typing. In fact, she'd often dictate her ideas to a typist or write out longhand. Wow. The actual book, which is kind of
clearly wasn't left-handed because she would have smeared every chapter.
Clearly. Yeah. And clearly had very strong wrists.
Right. No carpal tunnel there.
Can you imagine her with that little squeezy thing that lets your wrist really strong?
For a shake weight.
And her first draft, she would try to obviously do her best, but her revisions are where she really added in those, what we think of as Agatha Christie twists, red herrings, and little hints and clues. She would just get the story out on paper and she's like, I know where this, I want this to end, but the details, I'll go back and I'll weave them into the story to make sure that it really makes sense. So she didn't get too caught up or too precious on the first draft. She also took a lot of feedback and had a lot of people around her who she could talk about her work with, mm-hmm. including her family. Her daughter often gave her feedback on her work, which is really cute.
Yeah, that's
and cute. You know, one other thing about Agatha Christie is she's a little bit of a loon, a little loony, a little odd, a little queer, you might say. She disappeared famously for 11 days.
That's right.
In 1926, at the end of her first marriage had just dissolved. Her husband had cheated on her and had come out with that he was having an affair. It was around Christmas, December 1926. And she just fell off the map for 11 days. She totally disappeared. People had no idea where she was. And eventually she was found by the police. And she apparently, allegedly, had no memory of where she had been for the last 11 days.
So gnarly.
She was lying. She had to have known where she was, right?
I don't know. I mean, I could see that being a trauma response a lot of ways. I have to imagine that she had gaps. Maybe there was enough gaps that she said, if I piece together the story for police or whoever, this is going to get out to the world and they're going to think I'm batshit. So I feel like it's half and half. Yeah, she probably had moments where she was like, how did I end up here? But I think that you're right, that she may have been a little bit more conscious than she's leading on to be.
Oh, and see, I think the total opposite. I think she planned her and plotted her escape because she's a mystery writer. Who else could disappear without a trace for 11 days? I think she'd have to do it on purpose.
But in the 20s,
I think she'd have to do it on purpose.
There's no credit cards to track you. There's no CCTV footage. You have no footprint, right?
Okay. But she did literally have footprints. She abandoned her car in the middle of a bog. They found her car on the side of the road, and it was like an expensive car. And then they were like, where'd this bitch go? And I don't know, where'd she go? She had to have planned it. She couldn't have walked that far on foot. I just think that she planned it. I think that she was like, oh, you're going to cheat on me? You really think that's going to be the headline? Okay, cool. Real life Agatha Christie. But, you know, that's like in 1926, something like that happening. A little bit odd, a little interesting. Which gets us into what all many of the people that we mentioned who are prolific creators, some of the things that they have in common. First thing, they often are creating and making and doing during pivotal times in history where there's significant cultural or technological or social upheaval or change, like right now. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is they're allowed to be at the forefront of new movements or new ideas. And I think that that just means like they're exploring, they're able to like take the ball and run with it, kind of be the first. Agatha Christie, I mean, it was rare to have a female mystery thriller writer who was as prolific as she, even I would say like even today.
Yeah.
So I think that makes sense. And with that sort of like criteria, now is a really good time to be a prolific person. Think about the dawn of AI. Everything seems to be unprecedented these days. Like we're living in unprecedented times. When you think of that, Mel, is there anything that you're like, ooh, I think the next prolific person might be in this area or industry or like exploring these types of ideas?
The one that comes to mind for me that I think has the most focus is the world of AI and also AI protections. I can imagine that what will become most impressive is how AI becomes more regulated and curbed, I guess, in some capacity, because I don't know how many people are actually thinking about what are the inherent ramifications of unleashing this and letting it grow to exponential potential and spanning across so many different industries.
Oh, I think a ton of people are thinking about that. They just don't know have the answer.
Yeah, that's a better way to frame that. Yes.
But that's a good point. Yeah, like that there, that's really our most probably topical and uncharted area.
I would say so. I mean, and I think that will be something that, like, when I think about, okay, if it's 2023, what's going to be making history books that is going to be taught in grade schools over time? Obviously, the pandemic is still there. It's still happening. It still will be a focus. But also, I can see AI taking up a bigger piece of that puzzle, a bigger piece of that chapter in the coming textbooks. So That's where I would imagine that the next kind of prolific creators, whether that is software developers or legislators, or I'm not sure what that's going to encapsulate, but I think that could be a good place to look and see who is the originator going to come out from this. So that's what I'm thinking about.
Cool. I take that. The next thing that many prolific creators have in common is that they have a really deep network of collaborators and people who are there to give them feedback.
That feels like counterintuitive to me, because I would imagine that for many prolific people, you maybe have some like narcissistic tendencies. And so receiving feedback from others might actually send you into a spiral. So I'm like, yes, I'm not no on this by any means, but I don't see that being the common denominator.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that I think it's actually two sides of the same coin, because a ton of really prolific people have these like deep networks. Think of the Belle Epoque era in Paris and how many artists were like connected to each other, impressionists and inspiring each other, Gertrude Stein's salons, just so many people who were influencing each other's work and getting feedback from each other, but at the same time, and really socializing with each other. But at the same time, another super common theme is sort of like hermitage within like going internal or time alone, necessary time alone. In fact, many of these artists, like their time alone is necessary for them in a way and out of the spotlight in order to create. Vincent Van Gogh was his most prolific when he was in a mental hospital, like a mental institution. Emily Dickinson was basically like locked in her house for unknown reasons, perhaps because she had epilepsy, perhaps because she just didn't want to be around other people. And she was prolific. She actually wrote in the middle of the night, and no one knew she was a writer until she died. That's when they discovered her work. So to me as an introvert, that's very inspiring, because I'm like, okay, great. I don't have to be like out and floozy about the town talking to everyone in order to still be like,
to be like networking and going to events all the time.
yeah, exactly. In order to make
networking harder.
Yeah, it's really hard, and I'm not made for it. And prolific people, they have a routine. Like they've got discipline and work ethic. Yeah. Or just like obsession, dogged obsession. You don't even have to call it work ethic. You could say like they truly are hyperfixated on the task at hand or the idea at hand, exploring it to the nth degree and continuing to learn. So not feeling like they had a growth mindset, I guess we could call it, or they even employed, you mentioned iterating on an idea. They even employ that mindset of like agile when it comes to building something, so that, for example, if Ryan Murphy's show gets canceled, he's like, okay, great. Here's what we learned from this last thing. Let's improve it, improve that process for this next thing that I want to produce and pitch, and let's get it going and pitch it right now. A speed bump is not something that means slow down to these people. It means build better shocks so that the next time we run into a speed bump, we don't even feel it. Hey, Michelle breaking in here really quick to tell you a little bit about what's going on inside of the North Node this month. If you don't know, the North Node is our private members community for creatives and intuitive entrepreneurs and nonlinear thinking geniuses who want to marry spirituality, intuition, intellect, running a capitalism critical business, just like being cool, making things and being cool, and self-actualizing along the way. And every quarter we have a different concept that we work through. So as we move into Q4, oh my God, the content, it's so good. Our theme for Q4 is big money energy, which we absolutely adore. And this month in October, I'm actually teaching money shadow work. If you haven't done shadow work before, hold on to your butt. If you have, fantastic. Have you done it around money? It's a whole different ballgame. But this course, we go through together as a community, all 400, 500 of us. And each day there's a different prompt. answer the questions, we work through together. And it is incredible the revelations that people have, not just about the psychology of money for them, but also the potential blocks or I guess like spaces that they just haven't quite opened up in their mind or in their consciousness yet around what's possible for them. And, you know, that sounds all really good in theory, but in practicality, it always leads to finding money, making more money, being more comfortable around money, and honestly, thinking about money as this magical thing, which I don't know, I think it really is. So that's what's up in this month of the North Node. If you're curious about joining, our doors open at the end of the year and in the middle of the year, but you can join the waitlist. Sometimes we pull people off the waitlist when we have people graduate, and you can learn a little bit more at the link in our bio. Okay, that's all I've got for you. See you in the North Node.
Well, and I also wonder, like, when at what point does that become maladaptive? I think for the most part, that is an extremely productive trait to have, and that you're thinking about optimization constantly, because inherently that's focused on like, how do I better myself? Which I think most people are trying to strive for.
Yeah, it's a growth mindset.
Right. And I can also see how there is a very fine line between that productivity output mindset, but also like where that gets really problematic or dangerous for you as a human or for the others around you. Again, I can see a world in which that maladaptivity is there. And maybe we don't always talk about that piece when we think about these prolific people.
That's exactly why I had you on here. Yeah, I think that, you know, some of the mental models and frameworks that we also see in addition to these habits, right, of like perhaps obsession, like rigidity when it comes to routine.
Right.
Either like being super social, manic, or antisocial, like on the extreme ends of the spectrum, they all do also kind of like overlap with a lot of these people who are prolific struggle with mental health. You know, Yayoi Kusumi, she's a prolific artist. She's been in a mental institution in Tokyo since 1977. She lives there. She lives there permanently. And her studio is across the street. And that's why one of the reasons perhaps why she's able to be so prolific. And I mean, like, this could spiral into the whole thing of what even is mental health? What does it mean to be like mentally healthy? What is mental wellness? Is there a better or worse? Is it more just like this is the way that some people think? But I guess from the outside, many prolific creators are perceived to have mental health issues according to sort of like regular society. Any thoughts on that, Mama?
Yes, I have a study for you. So last quarter, I studied bipolar disorder was like one of my focuses for my diagnostics class. And there is a study that was done in 2015. And it connects and relates that people who are more likely to be perceived as artistic or creative have a higher likelihood of diagnoses for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And those can be morbid sometimes. So compared to the general population, those who are perceived as creative and actually maybe even having your brain wired in that way might encourage that creativity. We don't really know correlation, causation, that type of thing. So I don't want to say with total certainty, but there is an increase in relatedness between creativity and those two mental disorders in particular, which could suggest that, again, they're related. And that's the way that your brain works, the way that your brain sees things is different than others. And that's why it can be like more boundless, perhaps.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some mental models that creative people and like especially prolific people have are lateral thinking, which means they seek solutions indirectly through a creative approach. So they see the world just differently than other people. Mind mapping, able to visualize ideas, spatial synesthesia is really common.
Yes, yes, yes.
Inversion. So instead of thinking about a goal from how to start towards a goal, they sort of work backwards from it. Again, just these like ways of thinking and seeing differently. And that can be, we started this conversation, this is a perfect way to sort of land the plane, that can be perceived as like odd or weird, or there's something wrong with you. But like maybe that oddness and weirdness and thing that's like quote unquote wrong with you is actually, it's the reason you can do what you do.
Well, and I also think it's so interesting that we often celebrate these prolific people after they've died, when they're no longer a burden to society or a burden to those around them if they are struggling with their mental health. Vincent Van Gogh is a great example of that. Man made no money during his entire career, died young. And then all of a sudden, if you go to Amsterdam now, he has an entire museum named after him next to the Rijksmuseum. So I think that's also interesting in how we treat the living who are perceived in that way of, oh, you're odd and you should be therefore othered and ostracized right now because I don't know how to relate to you or care for you in a way that's sustainable for you. And yet when they die and we recognize like the sheer talent and potential there, that's when we can actually hold them to a pedestal and celebrate them and study them and find them worthy of value. That's problematic to me. That's an unfortunate pattern that occurs throughout history.
Well said. I mean, that's it. We could talk about this for literal hours, but you have to go and I have to go. So maybe we'll do a part two. But Mel, thanks for coming on the show. Yeah. Any way that you want to put a period at the end of this sentence about prolific people, about mental well-being, about creativity, about process?
Yes, I would say that comparison is the thief of joy is a thing that I often think about. And I think about in relation to my therapy practice and clients. When you are thinking about these prolific people or want to emulate them in many ways, take what sticks and throw away the rest. It can feel like a lot of pressure to follow to a T exactly what these folks are doing or thinking or however disciplined they may have been. And sometimes that's not going to work for you. And I would say that's what is coming up for me right now as we wrap this conversation up is, yes, there are so many amazing things and inspiring things about these stories. And we can pick and choose what sticks with us and what resonates with us and incorporate that into how we want to live.
Literally, amen, sister, because that's right. There's not one right way. There's not like, oh, all prolific people do this.
Right.
Bro, they're all over the fucking map. All prolific people, the one thing they have in common is they just make a ton of shit. That's it. That's the only thing they have in common. Seriously. So you too can be a prolific person. You just have to keep making stuff. That's it.
Yeah. Love that.
Thanks so much, Mamel. You're the best.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
The 12th House is produced by me, Katie Dalebout, with theme music by Nathan McKay and edited by the incredible Softer Sound Studio, who you can find more information about in our show notes.